As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Joining me this week, we have Rory K. Smith, Ollie K., and Matt Dickinson. Leicester City, they are champions. The headline in today's Times suggests that you would have got better odds on finding Elvis alive. And no, I didn't write the script. Dicko, is the king now truly alive and kicking?
It is the greatest story, isn't it? In certainly my sporting lifetime, it's the certainly the biggest upset. It's everything. And it's one of those things you probably rarely in football, you can't overhype. Just the scale of it in so many different ways, isn't it? It's the way we've been conditioned to thinking this is the era of the mega club, the super club, the rich elite. It's the way we've just been conditioned to thinking that, you know, okay, maybe a plucky sort of middle-class club might just have a sort of tilt at the edges of Europe, possibly. We've been conditioned to thinking Ranieri wasn't a winner, into thinking people like Danny Simpson and so many others were just journeyman footballers. So it's glorious in so many ways and glorious for Leicester, but just glorious for sports, for football, for allowing an awful lot of other teams, clubs to think, well, maybe if we get things right and do well, who knows, maybe it could be our turn.
Ollie, you tweeted about this, and I think, like me, I suspect you struggled to sort of go beyond football to find examples in other sports of upsets. And there have been remarkable upsets in one-offs. I mean, just in my lifetime, I'm thinking of Buster Douglas and Tyson. You know, people talk about the Miracle on Ice. People talk about Greece in the year 2004. But the remarkable thing about this is that it lasted 10 months. And I couldn't find any example from any other sport of a situation like this.
One of the things that was proposed when I was looking at greatest sporting triumphs of all time, I mean, one of them was the Super Bowl in 2008, which was New York Giants, New England Patriots. Now, American sport is by its nature, it is very equal, it's very egalitarian, the way money's distributed, the draft systems, etc. Everything about European football in particular, well, particularly over the Champions League era, is the opposite of that. It's very hierarchical. It's very, very difficult for clubs to bridge financial divides. You look across Europe now, you see teams winning the league umpteen times in a row. In Greece, you see it's five times in a row for Celtic in Scotland. PSG are going to dominate for a long, long time to come. And people will say, I saw a few tweets last night of people say, oh, you'd only get this in the Premier League. Well, this is completely contrary to everything that's been happening in the Premier League era. The Premier League era has been, yes, four different title winners over the past four seasons now, but everything has been about domination by the money. You know, the big rich teams, whether they're natural resources or whether they're the resources of people like Blackburn, Manchester City, Chelsea, who've bought their way to the top. The Premier League has been beyond Liverpool, it's been beyond Arsenal. If Tottenham had won it, it would have been incredible in many ways because they've only got the sixth biggest budget. And for Leicester to have done it, it is absolutely ridiculous. And I remember saying around Christmas time, you know, if this was Southampton or West Ham or even Stoke doing this or Everton doing this, we'd be saying, my God, this is incredible. And I think probably we've become less and less surprised as the season has gone on, but it is, I think, just absolutely astonishing that they've done it. Well, I was going to say over 38 games, but it's 36 games. They've done it with two games to spare.
Dicko?
And even on that point, I mean, as Ollie says, we've sort of become sort of less surprised. But I mean, I have to say, you know, I think I'll have to hold up my hand that, you know, even a month ago, I was sort of telling myself, no, you know, and when's the wobble coming and when's the panic going to set in? I mean, obviously, you know, you turn back to last August and the idea of someone saying to you, you know what, I just got a sneaky feeling for Leicester to come in the top six, you'd have laughed at them, to the top eight. But it's the fact that even a month ago, again, I think we're all such a shock that we're all thinking, well, they must wobble. There must be a panic. Man City must win, you know, six on the bounce and sort of restore the natural order of things. So most of us, say, even 3 or 4 games ago, were thinking, will they panic?
So the remarkable thing, too, about this, Rory, and what sets it apart from situations like the one that was mentioned to Ollie about the Giants in the Super Bowl in 2008, is that Leicester were the best team in the Premier League this season. If you look at, you know, by whatever angle you want to look at it, if you want to look at the points differential over the second place team, if you want to look at your fancy expected goals models, that they all have Arsenal, Spurs, and Leicester neck and neck. Whereas, you know, the Giants in 2008, that was dramatic because I believe that was the year of the him catching the ball off his helmet and everything. But there was a degree of happenstance in that game. There was a degree of probability, and they weren't the best team throughout the season. They didn't have the best record. It doesn't make any sense, does it, Rory?
Dicko touched on it. Leicester sort of inverts a lot of the things that we're told to be true, and that's what's kind of fascinating about it. So not just things like Ranieri, you know, always comes second, Ranieri can't win. There's that kind of narrative truth that we're told, but there's other stuff. There's the way they play, not in the sense that, oh, we know we should all be looking to hit, you know, hit goal in three passes now, but they run against a lot of the things that we were told were kind of the trends in football. Things like not having a ball-playing central defender. So most top teams now prioritise in scouting central defenders. You need someone to build the ball from the back, whether you are a Barcelona-style kind of possession team or a Dortmund-style sort of counter-punching team. You need that ball-playing central defender to kick-start attacks. Leicester don't. They contradict a lot of the things we're told about scouting and where talent lies. They contradict a lot of the things we're told about the progression through the ranks, through the leads. There's a lot of stuff that Leicester kind of have completely inverted, and that's what's astonishing. They challenge a huge amount of conventional wisdom in football.
Well, here's
so
another...
yes, it doesn't make sense if you assume that the conventional wisdom was entirely correct, but I think it probably wasn't. And I think there is now an element. We're going to hear this phrase. I want to do a Leicester. Zach Goldsmith used it this morning in the completely the wrong context.
Well, but why is it wrong for Zach Goldsmith? I mean, he's somebody who hard scrabble, comes from the lower classes, worked his way up.
But
yeah, he's never had any privilege in his life.
No one,
much like Leicester.
No one is saying in this room, Gab, that Zach Goldsmith is anything other than a scrappy working class hero. But the context in which he used it was, I want to come from behind and win. Leicester haven't come from behind and won. They've been top since when? November?
Yeah, that's and another one. The thing about the fan convention, I mean, we could actually make a little list about this. You know, one is obviously, like we said, that, you know, Ranieri is some kind of preternatural loser. Although, funny enough, I mean, he actually did win leagues in the past, albeit the lower leagues, and he did win cups and whatever. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I have a point on that. It's just that I did a piece on Ranieri last week that was in the paper on Saturday, and in the course of speaking to people who've worked with him, what kind of occurred is there is this one traditional way of looking at Ranieri's career, which is he's the nearly man. He can take you to a certain level, but never beyond it. But you can flip that the other way and say, well, for 30 years, he's been getting really, really close to winning the title. His record is actually amazing. It becomes a fluke, like a crazy fluke that he never won a league. That's what I was going
to
say.
That's one way to look at it. I don't know how accurate it is, but I'm actually writing a biography of one Claudio Ranieri, so I'll hope to get to the bottom of that.
When is that out?
And in September,
ooh,
inshallah.
Something to look forward to for everybody.
Exactly. But and I guess I'll direct this question to you, Ollie. There's obviously some incredible individual characters, incredible stories on this team, but one other bit of conventional wisdom, which I found remarkable, is I took the time to go through all these Leicester players, and I looked at what these people had won in their careers. You know, because there's people go on and on. Well, the winning mentality that, like, say, Mourinho has, and when you've won, you win more, and blah blah blah. You know, in this entire Leicester team, and I might be forgetting somebody, but I think I'm accurate, at least of the starters, you've got Ulloa, who won like the Argentine second division, and I think he won the Clausura or something, but he was the last guy off the bench when he was like a teenager. Robert Huth obviously won titles at Chelsea, where he was the fourth central defender and, you know, hardly ever
emergency
played.
Emergency striker.
I'm sorry? An emergency striker, yeah, under Claudio, when they didn't win. And you have Okazaki, who won the Asian Cup with Alberto Zaccheroni, naturally an Italian manager, winner. But that's it. None of these other people. And I don't know if Danny Simpson and Drinkwater got, you know, some kind of like chocolate Hanukkah Gelt medal for when they were in the youth team and United won things. But these people aren't winners. There's no such thing as winners. And then that's another thing we're told, right? We're told like so-and-so is a winner. These people aren't. They're losers. They're mediocrities who've many of whom have overcome incredible personal hardship as well. And they've won things.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was the fact that they won the championship 2 years ago. But then again, people aren't exactly looking at the Burnley squad who have just come up and saying, well, this experience is going to help them win the Premier League in 2 years' time. I mean, it is truly extraordinary. I mean, I know it's just probably boring to keep saying it is amazing, but it really is. And we haven't seen anything like it before. I mean, you talk about losers. Somebody like Mark Albrighton, who I thought had a really good few months when he first broke into the Aston Villa team. I thought he looked really promising. And then he just sort of drifted out of the team under Lambert and just sort of disappeared and was released on a free transfer, and it wasn't exactly a big scramble for his services. Leicester picked him up, and suddenly, although he hasn't been playing as much the last couple of weeks, I mean, he has looked a really, really good player. He's looked like one of the best wingers in English football. Hasn't been close to the England squad. And if you look at last season, they had Cambiasso, and Cambiasso was perceived to be the player who had that experience, who stopped a group of losers, to use your term, dropping into the championship. And he was perceived to be the one who kept them above. When he left, they signed Inler, which, again, sort of made sense, like for like, but he's barely appeared, has it? I mean, he's barely been on the bench.
And that's one of the most mystifying things about
this. Also, it's been, I mean, you know, on the one hand, this is a quite rightly being regarded as the great inspirational story, the sort of sense of, you know, Leicester, this, you know, town in the East Midlands, if they can do it, anyone can. But actually, we come back to the fact that so much has to fall right. And so many things, you know, you've got to get a system that just clicks and brings absolute, I mean, all these players, Albrighton's a good player, but he's probably, you know, had a sustained form of life. There's that sort of elusive morale, team spirit that just somehow gets on a roll.
Well, he suffered personal tragedy as well.
They haven't had injuries. There's just been a sense of, you know, obviously they're going to have European football next year, which is going to be a colossal, you know, burden, a very happy burden, but it's going to completely change the dynamic of their season. You're maybe not going to get Vardy on the consistency is, or Mahrez, or, I mean, there's just so many little things that, you know, have gone right, and they've gone right because of either good players, good management, but also a bit of luck. And it doesn't take, you know, it only takes two or three of those little things to go wrong to suddenly remind us how extraordinary this year was.
It is remarkable. Obviously, one other factor which helped them, no question about it, is that the other big boys, I think, all underachieved. And they really underachieved horribly. I mean, you know, if you're Manchester United, I mean, or Manchester City or Chelsea or Liverpool, or indeed Arsenal, you know, you look at this and you say, you know what?
Okay, Arsenal did not underachieve. Mm-hmm. Arsenal achieved exactly what Arsenal always achieve.
I think that's trite and silly. Arsenal finished behind Spurs and Leicester. Don't always finish behind Spurs and Leicester.
The true miracle of this season is that when everything changed, Arsenal stood still, and I think we should thank them for that.
But I think evidence of the fact that they underachieved is that of those five clubs, other than Arsenal, who are, you know, in their own little world, the other four have either changed managers or will change their manager. But there's also things that went badly wrong for Leicester. And I'll give you one example, which I think has been overlooked. Their recruitment has been praised by everybody. And, you know, and I think you've written about the guy Steve Walsh, who isn't that Steve Walsh, but is a different Steve Walsh, and his friend Wigglesworth, who's like some kind of analytic scouting genius. And then he went and he joined Arsenal. Though I guess there wasn't much to scout at Arsenal because all they signed was Peter Cech. But, you know, hopefully he'll have more work next year. I actually looked at Leicester City signings, and this to me just kind of, this kind of baffled me. So the 10 most expensive signings in Leicester's history, and funny enough, our friend James Scowcroft is number 10, by the way.
Nice.
Just gives you an idea of, and this was many, many years ago, just shows you what a player he was or how expensive he was. So 8 of those 10 have come in the last 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. With Steve Walsh and, you know, this regime. Of those 8 expensive signings that they've had, only 2, Conte and Okazaki, who, by the way, I think scored 1 goal this season, only those 2 are regulars in the Leicester team.
So you've got Joa, who's sort of the first substitute.
So you've got people like Kramaric, yeah, who's their most expensive player, Inler, who I don't think has played since January and couldn't get on the pitch. And again, he couldn't get on the pitch. Sorry?
Ben Aluan's
the big one. Ben Aluan, they spent, I think, £6 million on. This guy played twice. I could have probably told them that, look, Ben Aluan is a little bit psychopathic. You know, I don't even want to get him on the pitch. But whatever. I thought, and Ben Aluan, I'm also told, was a player that Ranieri really wanted because he thought he was hard and that's what they needed. So I think it goes to show, A, that recruitment is far from an exact science. And I'm not suggesting that Steve Walsh and his people haven't done well, because obviously they have through, you know, look at Fuchs and Al Brighton and obviously Mahrez.
But is that not the point? Is that so yes.
But I'm saying that kind of defies conventional wisdom too. Right, the fact that you can actually get so many things wrong, you can spend so much money badly, if you like, but in the end come out ahead because you get these other things right.
So what I would say to that, Dab, and I take your point entirely. No scouting system, whether it's numbers based or non-numbers based, or this, or they do this, or they do that, or they kind of dress up like dinosaurs and they don't watch the players, so that makes them play better, or whatever. None of them are perfect. I would actually say that Leicester's recruitment, and you're right that it's interesting. The bid money signings haven't.
Yeah,
worked out.
It's interesting.
There's the sort of shadow of a pattern there. But I would say that if you're getting, say, a 50% strike rate from your signings, you are way ahead of most teams.
That's what recruitment people keep telling you, so that they can hang on to their job and look good.
I think that's probably fair. There's so many factors, and it's almost entirely arbitrary. So I would say that Leicester haven't been perfect, and to dress them up as perfect. And this is really important, because the other interesting thing about Leicester is their impact on what happens next, like what this will do for English football, for the Premier League. And one of the things that it should not do is convince everybody they have to behave in any number of ways exactly like Leicester. There is an element of random choice here. That it happened to be Leicester who found themselves in the eye of the perfect storm, and that's amazing. It's an amazing story, but they do not represent a blueprint necessarily.
No, and I would agree with that. Although perhaps they're a bit of a blueprint in the way that guys like King and Ulloa, who'd been important players before, the way the manager kept them in the squad, kept them involved. I mean, I think that's something that's often overlooked when we talk about man management.
The thing I think I admire most about Leicester, the thing that's impressed me the most, is how little the pressure has affected them. I find that genuinely astonishing. Because I was like Dicko, we were like everybody. You think there is a wobble coming? There will be a wobble. There came a point where you thought, I think they can survive with a wobble, because there was about 6 weeks.
In January, wasn't it?
No, about 6 weeks ago, I sort of looked at the table, and I won't pretend this was any great sort of oracle, but you looked at it and thought, hang on, I can't see Spurs aren't going to win every game. Arsenal are going to continue to be Arsenal. City will continue to be City. I think Leicester, and there was a point at which I thought, hang on, Leicester can drop quite a lot of points and still win the league. Didn't think they'd do it with 2 games to spare. But the way the pressure hasn't got to them at all is fascinating. And I wonder whether that's partly because that's not something that would have applied had it been, say, Everton, who would have felt all that weight of history on them. Leicester knew that there is no history here. So that the pressure kind of didn't have that same meaning to the fans and to the players, and I think that perhaps played in their favour in the end.
So it's the joys of live radio or live podcast reporting, but Matt Dickinson has had a little bit of a technological breakdown. I'm sure that he is fine, but he's no longer with us, meaning he's no longer on the podcast, not that he's died or anything. It's all good, because there's more opportunity for us to talk and hear the sounds of our own voices. And so the voice I want to hear now is that of Ollie Kay. Ollie, I was struck by something Claudio Ranieri said, which was, he was speaking on Italian television, and he said, you know, he got the job, he did some research, he saw that they finished the season really well, he saw they were playing really well under Pearson, and his first thought when he arrived was, I'm not going to change anything. You know, I might bring in some competition for certain spots, but in preseason, my idea was like, you know, let's keep the same way of playing. And then he says, but then I realized we could go vertical really, really, really quickly, quicker than any team that I've ever been involved in. And I said, you know what? Let's change it. Let's just go north-south, and let's attack very, very quickly to a degree that we hadn't, that I'd never really done before. I mean, it seems so simple now, but it does take somebody to have a departure from what works, right?
Yeah, and if you look at the way they play, it is extraordinarily quick. Whether it's the way they get the ball forward, or it's the speed with which Kante wins the ball and then turns it into a counter attack immediately. I mean, the speed of Vardy, the acceleration of Vardy, and the way that they use him by defending so deep and giving him so much space to attack. I mean, that is all, I suppose, with hindsight, it's all incredibly obvious, but it is probably, it is taking it on a few degrees, I'd say, or several degrees from the way they were playing under Pearce. It's roughly the same way. He's not changed much in terms of the style or behind the scenes, but obviously there has been a huge improvement, and I think probably a lot of people would have looked at it last summer and thought that there wasn't any room for improvement, that with even if they were to sort of pick up where they left off and have a really good season and confound expectations, we'd be talking about an impressive mid-table finish rather than anything like this.
Well, that's one of the things that strikes me, because there's been an obvious change in their style of play under Ranieri, and it happened in the summer after Ranieri arrived. But by the same token, there's a guy named Dan Altman, who's one of those sort of football analytics types, and he makes the point that last season Leicester had actually been really, really, really unlucky with his expected goals modeling and stuff like that. Especially once they signed Robert Huth in January, they started defending so much better. And that in the second part of last season, he makes the point that based on his models, they were the fifth or sixth best team in the Premier League. Now, I hasten to add that he says that, because I think if any of us were to say that, we would probably all lose our jobs and get laughed at and tarred and feathered. So, Rory, since you're generally used to this kind of treatment, do you see that, or do you find that excessive? Were they that good last season?
I think
Conte?
They were much better than their lead position for a long time suggested they were. I don't think that's a particularly revolutionary claim.
Fifth or sixth best in the second half of the season?
I think is that not logical by the results? Just they won what? The last nine games, they were almost...
They won, I think, eight of their last
they
nine.
They won eight of nine, so that's the last quarter of the season. I would bet they were the best team in the league in the last quarter of the season, which means that it stands to reason that for the last half, they'd be pretty high up, yeah.
But there's a strange thing with it. I mean, I was trying to rationalise it, and then I looked at those final nine games of last season, and almost all of them were against teams that either had been relegated or were about to be relegated or had nothing to play for. It's a hugely impressive run of results, 7 wins, 1 draw, 1 defeat in the Premier League. But you couldn't say that at any point they looked like a team that was going to turn the Premier League on its head. I spoke to Nigel Pearson back in February. Yes. He at that point was saying they're going to win the league. I could tell. And the reason is, apart from that period mid-season where nothing was going for them, they were losing every week. Apart from that period, he felt at every point over the previous 2 years they have been performing to a real peak. And during that period when they dipped, they never let it get to them. They always persevered. The spirit never was never endangered or damaged. And he felt that, whereas other teams he could see, Arsenal, Tottenham, Man City, never mind the others who had not even come close, whereas those three teams were showing signs of cracking under the pressure of various sorts, he said that the pressure will just wash over this lot. They are an incredibly strong group. They believe in what they're doing, whether it's under Pearson or under Ranieri. And he felt that, that they would just achieve whatever the goal was, because they achieved their goal in winning promotion, they achieved their goal in staying up, they've achieved their goal, which obviously goals were adjusted and expectations raised as the season went on, but psychologically they dealt with it in a way that nobody expected them to, except perhaps those who knew the team best.
It's a good point that you make there about the spirit and the unity of the team. I mean, it's one of those cliches we often throw out there, but I think in this case it may well apply. Whatever the nature of these guys is, there was a humility to them. The stars aren't really stars, maybe because it's their first taste of stardom and whatever else. It's the inevitable question: if Pearson had stayed and he hadn't had those weird moments last year with the ostrich and Pat Murphy and all that nonsense, and they had made the exact same signings that they made this year, and Ollie, you've spent time with him, do you think they would have they would have won the title?
No, I think
he may be listening.
I'll change my phone number. No, it's only right to give Pearson a lot of credit for what Leicester have done, not only in getting them into the Premier League, but in keeping them in the Premier League and creating a system and a staff and a you know, building foundations that, in his opinion and in the opinion of many others who have stayed on, including people who are very loyal to Ranieri now, they all feel that what Pearson has done is a huge part of it, because that Ranieri came in and didn't really need to change very much, whether it's tactically or whether it's off the field, whether it's the structural stuff, whether it's the recruitment stuff that everybody's very... But having said all of that and having given all of that credit to Nigel Pearson, which I think is right, I mean, you have to say that they did not look like a team who were going to go on a huge run and win the league under Pearson. And maybe, you know, it just takes a different approach, somebody coming in with a different touch, maybe a lighter touch in some ways, which isn't very often you'd say that of an Italian coach, but it was a lighter touch, and it has lightened the whole place from everything I'm told. He has just sent them off in a different direction or propelled them upwards in a way that nobody can possibly have expected. And no, I don't think they would have won the league under Nigel Pearson, and that's well defending his legacy in quite a big way.
I think the question kind of answers itself, doesn't it? That there is no question that the chemistry at Leicester has been crucially important. You speak to any of their players, they have a very sort of unusual bond between the players that's been extremely helpful. That's not in doubt. The manager as well is part of the chemistry at the club. So it naturally follows that if the manager was different, even if the mythical Nigel Pearson of your imagination, Gab, existed, who didn't call people ostriches and didn't clash with Pat Murphy and wasn't Nigel Pearson, so like some sort of Nigel Pearson with none of the bad bits, then even if that sort of super Nigel Pearson existed, the chemistry would necessarily be different, so it probably wouldn't have worked to the same extent. They might have finished fifth or sixth or fourth, but I think it's very unlikely they'd have won the title with Pearson. I agree with Ollie entirely, and don't know Nigel Pearson.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Listen, so I can speak more freely about him.
Right, moving on to the reason they became champions. Chelsea, of course, came from behind, 2-0 down against Tottenham to draw 2-2. I'm sure we'll have more opportunities to talk about the job Pochettino did, and I think we all have a lot of respect for what Spurs achieved season-long. But I want to ask you, Ollie, you were there, I was there as well. What looked like a psychological meltdown from Spurs with the nine yellows and... whatever, Clattenburg has his own style. I think he could have used some reds early on. Mm. But, you know, we're looking at Dembele being in trouble for eye gouging. I think Dier belongs in a straitjacket if he's going to do that late in the game. And, you know, and people go, well, it's just frustration. You know, yeah, you know, I think that everybody's frustrated, right? But only certain people go and do some of these psychotic challenges at that stage. But is this something that, you know, you just kind of... Is this something that surprised you? Because for so much of the season, Spurs had actually shown a lot of discipline, even in the face of adversity.
Yeah, you would say that they are not, that they have not looked most this season like a team managed by a former Argentina central defender. I think last night they probably looked like that. You know, it was very bad tempered. It was rugged in sometimes in a good way, often in a bad way. And it was there was a real lack of emotional control in the second half in particular. And there was some really horrible, snidey stuff happening off the ball. I would say that of both teams. I mean, it wasn't just Tottenham by any means. It was a game played in a very competitive spirit, but it was that old-fashioned competitive spirit which we love, or I love anyway, was overshadowed by a very modern, snidey, ugly spirit which I think did neither set of players any credit, and it's a shame to be saying that about Tottenham in a season which they've performed so well and won so much admiration. But I thought they were I thought they let themselves down, and I can understand the frustration, but I cannot understand why Dembele did what he did. And I mean, that was the main one, but yeah, there was all the pushing and shoving constantly throughout the game, and the pushing and shoving at the end, just hitting, ending up on his backside, which is, it was not a very dignified way to end. Which probably Chelsea and their players and their fans will have found very funny to see Spurs losing their heads and losing their points and losing the chance for their first title in 55 years.
It'd be interesting to know. We will never know how much of it was a response to provocation. Not that there's anything wrong with Chelsea provoking Spurs, that's part of the test, but there was a little bit of footage that emerged last night of Willian sort of brushing the champion's crest on his arm in the direction of the Spurs players during the game, which is, some would say, a little bit irritating, I imagine.
Are you serious? Honestly, please name names. I want to know who would say something like this, someone who would have a problem with that. Who would use that as some kind of justification?
No. I'm not saying it's a justification. I'm saying that it indicates that there was a lot of kind of...
Yeah, these are two local rivals who don't like each other. I have no problem. I mean, honestly, as long as William doesn't touch him, I have no problem what he does with the
press. I am not saying that it's Chelsea's fault for what Spurs did. What Spurs did was a loss of control. I'm saying that it was a game of extremely heightened emotions, and Spurs cracked a little bit, basically. That's what happened. It would be interesting to know, we will never know exactly kind of which flashpoints set things off, set them in that train.
But what's mysterious is some of this stuff happened early when things were going great for Spurs. Yeah. And as a big England fan, I worry about that. I mean, Kyle Walker...
That occurred to me as well.
Kyle Walker, was it on Pedro or Azpilicueta early on?
They were mainly on Pedro.
That was early in the game. Mm. You're 2-0 up, and then this kind of stuff starts happening. You know, Dyer going all Dyer at the end, whatever, you know. But, and Mason, this is what you expect from him.
There was only really one bad one from Mason that wasn't
I'm sorry. I don't want to have a go at Mason, but I don't understand where he fits into this team. He looks like a bad version of Cattermole, you know, relative to the other people who, but whatever. I don't want to get sidetracked on Mason. But I don't know. It does kind of make you wonder about sort of the collective loss,
and is there
a point to be made here about leadership? And the reason I ask this is that you've got a team with a lot of young players. Mm-hmm. The older players are people, you know, are 26, 27. People like Eriksen. People, I guess Lamela is what, 25. Harry Kane's 25, around there.
No, 22, or
whatever. I guess so. He's been
just looks like a 1950s businessman.
But you know, Vertonghen, they don't strike you as, you know, the kind of fire leader who can quite.
I don't know.
Is that figure overrate the importance of that figure?
It's more than that. Spurs are a very young team, and watching it last night, you thought this is a young team who don't know how to cope with this, that they have cracked. I wondered whether it might spill over into a little bit more kind of. You would hope not. Obviously, I'm an enormous England fan as well. You'd hope not. It wouldn't linger into the Euros. But in terms of the experience, they are a young team. But Vertonghen's experience, Alderweireld's experience, Lloris's experience, there's enough there.
Lloris is in goal. Yeah. Oh, Eriksen's another one. Do you think Eriksen? Can you imagine Eriksen shouting at his teammates?
No.
Eriksen shouting at Dyer and Walker and pulling him up.
One form of leadership, Cap.
I don't doubt that. It's just Eriksen doesn't, gifted as he is, doesn't strike me as an obvious leader type.
But do you think it could affect Spurs in the long run? Does that is a difficult thing to come back from?
It's been suggested to me that Pochettino built a team like this without sort of the bigger senior veteran characters and without people who maybe he considered possibly slightly troublemakers, people who thought he knew better, because he had a very clear idea of what he wanted to do and how he wanted to work, and he wanted to have control. And that's part of the reason why, you know, they can have double training sessions at Spurs and nobody complain. I think they're the only club in the Premier League, and we've talked about this, who can do it regularly, and you don't have people complaining or bunking off. He got rid of some characters like that. He made a change with, I think it was the team doctor, the physio, because he wanted that kind of power. Maybe in a game like this, you know, it cost them a little. Ollie, you get the final word.
Yeah, I thought it looked like there were instructions to Spurs players, you know, stand up to what Chelsea are doing. You know, don't let them bully you. And I think if you look at the first 5 minutes, they were giving as good as they got. I mean, there was a Rose challenge, wasn't there? There was a Walker challenge. And look, for one thing, I thought the referee didn't do a good job. He didn't control it. It reminded me a little of Howard Webb in the World Cup final, where he needed to lay the law down very early and stop it.
But it's class. Come on.
You know, early yellow cards, even an early red card, never mind this ruin the spectacle business. It's got to be fair. It can't be allowed to get out of hand. And if you look at the incidents one by one, I mean, I think it's probably a little harsh that we're just singling out Spurs. I think Chelsea, a lot of Chelsea players did things they shouldn't have, but the attempts to provoke from Tottenham were the things you wouldn't really normally see from Tottenham. I can't remember, was it Alderweireld or was it Vertonghen grabbing Costa by the neck?
There was with Diego Costa's jersey, it was Vertonghen.
But Alderweireld did something I can't remember quite what it was, and he's a player who has barely even committed a foul all season.
He's a guy named Toby. Come on,
he's not committed a foul since November. It's insane.
It looked like a team who were trying to prove something in a different way, and I can totally understand why they wanted to stand up and impose themselves physically in a way that perhaps people thought that they couldn't. And when they were winning 2-0, it all looked pretty laudable in terms of their ability to stay calm, even though they could have had a player sent off by then. But ultimately, yes, they did crack, and it's not where it's like Liverpool at Crystal Palace a couple of years ago. That's not where they lost the title. They lost the title by
West Brom,
by dropping silly points at times and giving themselves too much to do. And
I don't like the phrase that Spurs lost the title.
No, exactly.
Leicester won the title.
No,
Spurs haven't lost anything.
I do agree. And Spurs would have been, if we're talking about bookies odds and that kind of thing, Spurs would have been sixth favourites, I would think, at the start of the season. And they've done well if they finish second. And they're probably the one out of those six teams that can look at themselves and look at their season with even the slightest degree of satisfaction.
Big, big story from last week. You know, there's that horrible word after tragedy called closure. I can't imagine that closure ever comes for the people who lost loved ones in Hillsborough, or even just the ones who were there and witnessed the horror. But obviously, I think, what was it, 3 years after the Hillsborough Independent Panel and Dave Cameron's apology on behalf of the nation finally came to court. And once again, you know, we reaffirmed what I think many of us knew, although maybe not to this degree, that there was a tremendous amount of basic dishonesty from the people that we expect to protect us and take care of us in the form of the police, to some degree, I think the ambulance service as well. Ollie, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the thought is, I mean, as you say, it isn't closure, it isn't justice for what's happened at all. I mean, there can never be closure, there can never be justice for what's happened, but I think the widespread probably refusal in the past, whether it's media, whether it's opposition fans, whether it's authorities, etc., the refusal to accept the reality of that situation, of what happened that day and of how disgraceful it was, how inadequate the policing was and had been through English football for a long time, how inadequately fans were treated for a long, long time. And it was probably, you know, moving towards something like this at certain grounds which weren't safe, at certain incidents, certain games which did have the potential for things to go wrong. But so much went wrong that day. So many awful decisions were made in the lead up to the game, whether it was by the FA, whether it was by the South Yorkshire Police, failing to entrusting the match to a guy who was totally inexperienced, who appeared to have sort of risen without trace through the through South Yorkshire Police. Whether it was Sheffield Wednesday, who had that sort of inadequate stadium, inadequate situation at that end of the ground, which had been neglected for years, and yet they'd still been given FA Cup semi-finals. And it's good that all of those failings have now been acknowledged and writ large in a way that, I mean, a lot of it was already out there. A lot of these failings were highlighted in the original Taylor report in 1990. But you know, blame has been attached now. Unlawful killing as a verdict has been attached now. There's been the individual inquests, rather than just treating that this is as a mass of people who died due to an unfortunate set of events. There have been individual inquests and individual causes of death found, even to be talking about it, look, of course it's not justice, of course it's not closure, but I think it's extremely important, not just for those people, not just for the people of Merseyside, not just for football fans, but it's important for this country to know that one of the greatest tragedies of recent times was a miscarriage of justice. It was caused by complete neglect, and it was followed by a travesty, which was the police cover-up and the attempt to pin the blame elsewhere, which is utterly disgraceful. And I can understand how mistakes happen when people are out of their depth in their job, the negligence of that age in terms of health and safety, and the several disasters that occurred of similar type in different fields. But you cannot ever forgive the cover-ups, and I hope it's for the cover-ups that people suffer and are made to pay the consequences of their actions.
I think that's an incredibly important point. I think there are two elements. I find it really hard to talk about Hillsborough, but there are two elements to it. If the disaster had occurred through negligence, through incompetence, through the mistakes of the police, this is something that is very, very important, I think, is the context of the time. So as the evidence emerged, first in terms of the panel and then the inquests, it should be remembered that the mistakes the police made came partly because of, as the end result, the sort of tragic end game of everything that had happened for the previous 25 years since the rise of hooliganism. And I think we should all be able to forgive people their mistakes and their, even if they have horrible, horrible tragic consequences. That's one thing. And that's one thing for which the police, and to a lesser extent, the ambulance service, Sheffield Wednesday, the FA, Henry did an excellent piece the day after.
Yeah. Henry Winter. It's worth going back and reading.
Very much worth. The FA have got questions to answer, and a lot of the anger has been directed rightly at South Yorkshire Police. There's been a lot of anger rightly directed at the Sun. The FA, to an extent, have questions to answer as well. Not as serious as South Yorkshire Police, but certainly serious questions to answer. But there is the other element, and it's the other element that I think is the most malicious and vindictive and difficult to deal with, and that is what happened after the disaster. If the disaster had happened and South Yorkshire Police had held their hands up and said, we made some horrible mistakes, this one is on us, we take responsibility, we will learn from this, we are terribly sorry, that would have been bad enough. That would still have been an unimaginably awful experience for the families and the survivors to go through. It's a huge word, but what happened next borders on evil.
I think what you just said is extraordinary and just so important. And I speak obviously as a foreigner, as a guest in this country. there is the dimension, obviously, of Hillsborough on the day and the tragic experience by the families. But what I find remarkable is that you're talking about 27 years. You're talking about four prime ministers, a Labour government, a Conservative government. You know, the fact that the Taylor report came out in, you know, not that long afterwards. You know, the elements were there. And that this acceptance of the police version of events, this acceptance of nothing to see here. You know, you can make the point that from the point of view of democracy, here it happened with 96 people who went to a football match and didn't come home. It could happen with a nuclear leak. It could happen with going to war with another country. It could happen with stuff that affects millions and millions. And so even if you don't care about football, and if you don't care about football, you're probably not listening to my voice right now, but if you don't care about football, if you don't care about Liverpool, if you don't care about Hillsborough, if you've had enough, just pause for a minute to think what happened and the level of cover-up and the level of collusion that went on for so long and the courage of some of these people who kept the campaign alive for so many years. And these aren't just sort of deluded people who lost parents or grandkids. Just imagine the courage that they showed for these past two decades, and you know, and the fact that, you know, eventually be grateful that eventually we got to at least the truth, but worry that it took so long.
Hillsborough is not a football story. Hillsborough is not now 27 years on. It's not the significance of Hillsborough is not really to do with football. It had huge seismic impact on kind of how we viewed football and what football is. There is a very strong argument to say that everything the Premier League is, all the sort of wonderful entertainment that Leicester and all that has provided this year, is built on the blood of the 96. But what Hillsborough represents is something that's enormously more significant, and that's evidence of what Britain was in the 1970s and 1980s, and that's something that needs to be analysed by people vastly more intelligent than me. I tweeted on the day of the inquest, and again, it's something I'm not a subject, it's not a subject I'm particularly eloquent on Hillsborough, so I find it very difficult. But if you take the route through the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, Orgreave, Hillsborough, everything that we've unearthed about Jimmy Savile and all of the stuff, the horrible stuff that's come out, I was born in 1982, the country I grew up in is not the country that it thought it was. And it's astonishing what was happening in this country in the 1980s. I'm the furthest thing from a conspiracy theorist that you can possibly imagine. But there needs to be a deep analysis of Britain's relationship with power, the deference for power, that led to all of these things happening.
Right, moving on to some quick hits. Some of us were expecting the mother of all anti-Wenger protests at the Emirates. Instead, all we got in Arsenal's 1-0 win over Norwich was a bit of a damp squid, as only a minority seemed to participate. Ollie, in a weird way, does Wenger actually come out of this strengthened?
I suppose in some ways he does. I mean, I think there are two things. I think there's one, the sentiment of whether people think Wenger is the right person to lead Arsenal forward, whether they think they can win the league under Wenger. But beyond that, there is a feeling of, well, should we really be angrily voicing dissent towards Arsene Wenger? Does he not deserve more respect than that? And I think he does.
There's a battle for fourth place going on involving Manchester City, United and West Ham. Rory, your thoughts? Want to take this opportunity to praise West Ham and your pal Slaven Bilic?
Yeah, I think West Ham probably slightly aggrieved, really, I guess, that Leicester and to some extent Spurs exist this season, as they have been what would ordinarily be an extraordinary story, and they've been kind of overlooked. I don't think they will get a Champions League place. I still think City will hold on and Arsenal get third. But no, West Ham, brilliant season, exciting times. Want to sign Cedric Bakambu.
There you go. Manuel Pellegrini is grumpy. He plays his B team at Southampton. They're terrible, and they get rolled over. Apparently, he was resting them ahead of the Champions League semi-final with Real Madrid, which seems logical to me, but doesn't sit well with some City fans I encountered on Twitter who fear it could cost them a top-four finish. Ollie, what's your take?
Well, I was actually surprised he even played as many senior players as he did. If you look at his team selection in for that FA Cup tie at Chelsea, which was, again, I think 72 hours before a big Champions League away game, he went with the kids that day. I thought he might, you know, whether City finish in top four or not probably doesn't matter to Pellegrini.
Jurgen Klopp also played a bunch of guys few had ever heard of, resting regulars ahead of a big European night, and got pummeled by Francesco Guidolin's Swansea. But Roy, I guess that was okay with everybody, right?
It's okay by me because I'm delighted Swansea's staying up. I think Francesco Dwidolin seems like a very nice man. I think Liverpool's injury problems mean that it was probably inevitable. I know what Ollie means when he says that Pellegrini, it's the two sides of the same coin, when he says that Pellegrini might have played too many first-teamers. So I guess, without question, I see what Klopp was doing. I do worry a defeat in the middle of two big games affects you negatively.
Ollie, we assume that two out of Newcastle, Sunderland and Norwich are going down, though I think Palace could be relegated too. They're not safe mathematically. Wouldn't that be funny? Who are your two picks and why?
Norwich, because I think they have the toughest run-in. And I've just done, as we've been waiting for this, I've just done a prediction thing for the last few results, and it's got Sunderland and Newcastle finishing level on 37 points and seemingly Sunderland staying up on goal difference. And the good news for Newcastle fans is that my predictions have been badly wrong all season, so it looks like you're safe.
We learned that hair pulling is a form of sex masochism, and that Louis van Gaal only wanted to come for 2 years, but Ed Woodward demanded 3 years. Roy, what's the more startling revelation for you, and any wise thoughts on the on-again, off-again arrival of Jose Mourinho, which is picking up steam again?
My thoughts on the on-again, off-again arrival of Jose Mourinho are that the more noise there is, the more distant it is, because if Mourinho thought he had it, he would be quiet. So when the point to think he's got it is when he stops talking.
This isn't just Duncan Castles talking about it. This is Sam Wallace, too.
Stop leaking things. I was sure it was Mourinho, and I'm getting less sure, which, as in the same way as Ollie in his predictions, means I'm... He'll probably be appointed today. The sex masochism thing, I knew that that was a form of sex masochism. So,
really? Hair pulling?
Yeah. I mean, it's not one that I indulge in, but okay. I knew it existed. Gab, I've got a question for you. Your column was absolutely excellent.
Once again, I really
enjoyed it, much more than I normally do. You had a bit of a go at Mats Hummels, the Borussia Dortmund and soon-to-be Bayern Munich central defender. Why are you so annoyed?
I'm so annoyed that in the year that we all believe in fairy tales and heroes once again, with Leicester winning the title, Mats Hummels, the man who came through the ranks at Bayern Munich, was rejected by the wise head of Jurgen Klinsmann, went to Borussia Dortmund, had the chance to return to Munich and said no. He seemed to buy into that whole thing. It was this narrative of Francesco Totti saying no to Real Madrid, Alan Shearer saying no to Manchester United. It means more. You're at a club where you've already won titles. You're a world champion. You play in front of the biggest crowds in Europe, four straight runnings. You have an exciting new manager. And now what? Now you want to go back? You want to join Bayern Munich? And there's nothing wrong if you want to go to the traditional powers. But my God, you stand for something, and you jump ship to your arch rival, just like Götze before you, just like Lewandowski. But with Hummels, I think it hurts more because he rejected them before. And, you know, I'm told that he's not going to make more money and whatever else, and it's not about that. And, you know, why would you go and just trade a walk-on part in the war for a lead role in a cage in that way? It'll be curious to see how it ends, too, because he's got a year left on his contract. There's even suggestions that Borussia Dortmund might say, hey, how about you sit for the next 12 months?
As they did with Lewandowski.
No, as they didn't do with Lewandowski, because... Lewandowski actually played and played very well.
You think they might banish him to the reserves?
I would lock him in a room for the next 12 months and see how he enjoyed that. Or I would try to sell him to Manchester City or Real Madrid or whatever else.
The one thing I did disagree with you in your column was this fear that Dortmund won't be able to replace him. I think that Hummels is extremely good, but is not certainly not flawless, as anyone who watches him knows.
I don't think I wrote that they weren't going to be able to replace him.
Perhaps I interpolated. I apologise. But I actually don't think it's that much of it. It's a blow to Dortmund, but I don't think in a football sense it's as much of a blow.
I agree. In a football sense, I think Hummels, it's more the symbolism of what it stands for. It's the fact that somebody can come into your house and take your kids or wife, you know? Which I suppose...
I mean, I think that's more serious.
Yeah. More than Hummels?
Especially if you've been engaging in sex masochism.
And Hummels is very handsome, although he cut his hair now, so that type of sex masochism isn't
maybe
quite
that's
as
why. Maybe it was becoming too much of a risk.
Clearly.
During love play.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my guests today, Roy K. Smith, Ollie K., and Matt Dickinson, who unfortunately had to leave us early. Please press that subscribe button. We're going to be back next week. And remember, you can get exclusive football highlights free as part of your subscription at just £12. for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.